This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
5 days in this economy in 5 minutes, because it's Friday. Also, a lesson in creativity from the golden days of hip-hop. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, the 27th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Yes, impeachment, of course. We will give that a nod. But we do business and economics, you know. So let's get to it. Catherine Rempel is at the Washington Post. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
All right, Catherine, you get the first bite at the apple, and it goes like this. My operating premise here is that Washington and Capitol Hill and Congress were already stuck. There was no major legislation moving. So what is the economic big deal of impeachment?
I think that there are a few ways that this could play out that could affect the economy. One, of course, is that we have these trade negotiations looming with China, as well as with other economies. And there were presumably a number of reasons why China, for example, might have been wary about making a deal with this administration, having seen how previous deal-making has been handled, you know, Trump threatening tariffs on Mexico, for example, after a new NAFTA was signed. But now, if they're worried about whether this guy is even going to stick around, you could imagine that that makes it even harder to convince them to come to the table. And beyond that, you could also imagine that Trump might decide to do more drastic stuff. You know, he wants to look tough. Mm-hmm. He's reportedly threatening some sort of capital controls on investment. And in, well, I guess we'll get to that. Yeah. But you could imagine that there are additional wild cards that could be thrown into the mix, as well as even greater uncertainty about whether we'll ever get to yes on any of these trade deals.
So, Sudeep, take the flip side of that for me, would you? And it goes like this. The president now, in some political trouble because of impeachment, wants to do what he can in his election campaign and thus strives to make a deal with China.
Yeah, it would be wonderful to bring a sense of clarity to all of this with normal logic, but that's not really how these things work. We've lurched from week to week with totally different storylines in the world around us. The conventional wisdom is impeachment is going to take 3 to 6 months and consume everything else. And the president, who obviously has some challenges staying focused, is going to be focused on the noise and the political drama, because that's part of what got him into this mess with Ukraine, is the political drama around Joe Biden. The alternative, though, is that other things happen in the world. Other things happen with Iran, with the stock market, with other risks to the presidency, and the president is going to try to find some way to look strong. And so the key to all of this, to the key to being a good negotiator, the key to the art of the deal, if you will, is strength. And he's going to have to find some way to look strong in the face of weakness with all the chatter of impeachment around him.
I see what you did there. Okay, so Catherine, on that topic of looking strong, you alluded to it. The president now, it is being reported by Bloomberg, I saw this morning, is talking about some kind of capital controls on investment in China and also perhaps limiting Chinese access to the American stock markets. That is, could be, if true, a big deal.
That is a very big deal. I mean, these are the kinds of actions that we normally associate with developing countries, to be clear, as well as some other things that this administration has done, you know, protectionist policy, industrial policy. So in that sense, I guess it's not entirely out of character. But look, this is a very bizarre line of attack. It's not exactly clear how this is going to pressure China to do anything, whatever it is that the Trump administration wants. You know, the Chinese population has a lot of savings that they can themselves invest. And beyond that, you know, it could put at risk the dollar supremacy if, in fact, it looks like there are new restrictions on your ability to get money out of the U.S. and where you can invest your dollars. So it's a peculiar tack. We don't really know where they're headed, if they're headed in this direction. But there are a number of reasons to be suspicious about whether this would be a wise strategy for any of the administration's objectives.
All right, Sudeep, layer all of that with this, which is the macroeconomic reality, which is that the global economy is slowing. We learned this week that gross domestic product in this country is lower than we thought. Consumer spending is slowing, and it is all not very promising.
It is not very promising. You have the combination of factors that fall into the big bucket called uncertainty. Mm-hmm. The very idea of uncertainty is hard to pin down. It's business uncertainty. It's consumer uncertainty. It's trade uncertainty. You don't ever really know what precisely is causing it, but you have a lot of people looking at this picture and thinking, is this where I really want to step in and make make my bets and take a risk? And that is all against the backdrop of a rising risk of recession. And all of that comes together to get people to close up and get a little scared and fear some trigger that tends to lead to bad outcomes.
I don't think I've actually done this with you two. I do it with some of the other folks who come on Fridays. But Catherine, you get to go first. Give me a quick gut check on the economy. How are you feeling?
You know, we have a lot of mixed signals right now. So it's I don't think the sky is falling. I think that there are a number of things to be nervous about, including the decline in business investment, including worries from consumers who have been the engine of this economy recently. So there are a number of things to be worried about, but I don't think we're about to go off a cliff. If, in fact, the administration could get its ducks in a row and remove some of this uncertainty, reduce this trade uncertainty in particular, I would be much more optimistic.
A very big if they could. Sudeep, 15 seconds, same question.
In the last decade, we've seen so many scares. I remember one around 2011, 2012, another one around 2015, 2016. And, you know, we got through those. We might have thought it's all going to fall apart now. We got through those. So you have to be cautious if you're a pessimist in this moment. But there aren't a whole lot of reasons for extreme optimism in this moment either. And that should be a concern and a caution for the optimists as well. And it kind of leads you to a shrug emoji at the end. It's a cautious moment that we're all living through.
I'm shrugging right now. Sudeep Reddy at Politico. He's in Washington. And Catherine Pell at The Washington Post. She is in New York. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street this Friday, there was a lack of enthusiasm, shall we say. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Oil. The U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate, to be specific, was down almost 1% at the close in New York today to just under $56 a barrel. It's been a choppy couple of months for crude, most recently after the attacks on those Saudi Arabian processing facilities just a couple of weeks ago. And that is directly relevant to the news out of Riyadh today that the Saudis are going to start issuing tourist visas. Not for business people, not for religious travel. Those have been going for a while, but plain old tourist visas for nationals of more than 40 countries, including this one. It's all part of the Saudi plan to diversify its economy to do something other than pump oil. But as Marketplace's Scott Tong puts it, if they build resorts, will people come?
As far as cool places to see in Saudi Arabia, there is some magic in the kingdom. Ancient civilization sites, a historic port city, huge stretch of the Red Sea. Karen Young is a Middle East scholar at the American Enterprise Institute.
There are mountains, there are places where it actually snows, so it's not always hot and desert. But along the Red Sea coast, it is quite hot, and so I don't think we would see a whole lot of beachfront tourism in the summer months.
In the next decade, the Saudis plan to invest hundreds of billions in roads, airports, hotels, and cover some of those costs by selling stocks in the state oil company. Young thinks Saudi Arabia can lure seaside and archaeology fans, but even regionally, there's plenty of competition for these tourists.
people who go to Egypt and see the pyramids or do cruises along the Nile, people who go to the holy sites in Jerusalem.
In Saudi Arabia, one challenge for Westerners will be its conservative Islamic culture. It's a place that frowns on single women and men seen together. And media scholar Paul Sullivan at the National Defense Institute warns that bringing in foreign practices too quickly can dilute the home culture. He recalls a trip to a conservative Islamic country he would rather not name.
What do I see but a very severe-looking fellow with a long black beard drinking Heineken while watching a go-go dancer? It was a completely broken cultural moment.
If the Saudis open up too fast, he warns there could be a popular backlash. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Monday will start the third week of the United Auto Workers strike against General Motors. And depending on the analyst you talk to, the shutdown is costing the company anywhere from $25 to $100 million a day. It's costing workers, too, obviously. And the longer it goes on, the more those costs for everybody mount. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson takes a look at where things stand.
A couple of things suggest GM and the UAW are getting closer to a deal, but how close is still tough to say. First, the UAW announced earlier this week that all outstanding issues are now being worked on at the main negotiating table instead of in specialty subcommittees. Christian Gicek with the Center for Automotive Research says that means that two sides are down to the toughest issues.
It's a system of issues, right? And, you know, each thing influences the other. So it has to be taken as a whole and has to be done at the very top levels of the negotiating teams.
Another potential indication of progress is that GM has reversed course and says it will continue paying for workers' health care while they're on strike.
You know, I think it's an encouraging sign that we may be close to the end of the strike, that, you know, GM is just like, you know, let's not worry about that. Let's get to the issues on the table and get to a solution.
Gicek says it could then take the UAW membership a couple of weeks to vote on a tentative agreement. One outstanding question is whether workers would go back to work during that time. And there's no guarantee union workers will ratify the deal. Susan Sherman, a professor in the School of Management and Labor Relations at Rutgers University, says in order to win approval,
the union is going to have to take a tentative agreement to its members that shows some real movement on particularly the issue of the temporary workers.
She says both sides will be hoping that more than a bare majority of workers approve the contract. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And then it comes time for me to start recording my rhyme.
Not as easy as it sounds, everybody. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial down 70 points today, 0.2%, 26,820. The NASDAQ coughed up 91 points, 1.1%, 79.39. The S&P 500 gave back 15 points, about a half percent, 29.61. For the week, the Dow shaved off 0.4%, the NASDAQ down 2.1%, the S&P 500 down 1% even. So, yesterday I said Peloton was PLTN. It's not. It's PTON. PTON. The latest unicorn to underperform on its IPO day. Shares of the bike company, which is maybe not entirely what they do. Anyway, down 2% today. After months of searching, scandal plagued Wells Fargo has named a new CEO and president, Charles Scharf, currently chairman and CEO of the Bank of New York Mellon. Wells Fargo shares up 3.7% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everyone. I'm Rima Khres, host of This is Uncomfortable, a new podcast from Marketplace that explores the thing we're always in our feelings over but don't really know how to talk about, money. This is a storytelling podcast that digs into things like how someone can feel like an imposter when they move from one socioeconomic class to another, or why so many people lie about what's in their bank account. We'll even teach you how to ask everyone you know about how much they make. But just to be clear, this is not a personal finance podcast. It is a podcast about life and how money messes with it. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Most days on this program, if you're one of those who listens to the numbers all the way through, and remind me to tell you my theory about that one day, but if you usually do listen all the way through, you most days hear me say something like, bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.68%. Just because I say it, though, doesn't mean everybody gets it or what it means. So for today's installment of our series, Kai Explains, where we take things real slow to explain what's really going on, the bond market.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
You recently asked what's going on with this economy.
So how do these two concepts work together?
You want to know what's going on in this economy? The bond market is a pretty good place to start. Bonds are, in their most basic form, IOUs. A city or the federal government or a company sells bonds, those IOUs, sometimes called debt, with the promise that after a certain period of time, called the maturity date, you're going to get your money back, plus some interest. That interest is called the yield. And there are all kinds of different bonds out there yielding different things. We mostly pay attention to what are called treasuries.
It's debt that's issued to investors by the U.S. Treasury to fund our deficit.
That's Kathy Busjancic. She's the chief U.S. financial economist at Oxford Economics.
The bond market or the fixed income market reacts very closely with changes in economic news or data.
Data like?
Monthly employment payroll data or consumer price data are published by the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Or in a nutshell, a lot of the economic essentials you hear us talk about on this program. Now, within all the different kinds of treasuries, there are government bonds you can buy that mature in a couple of days all the way out to 30 years. And within that, there is one bond that we watch the most.
If you're a U.S. consumer or U.S. investor, the 10-year treasury note is probably the first benchmark to keep an eye on.
That's Ryan Phillips. He's at Sagevest Wealth Management.
It's really a general barometer of interest rates in the economy.
Because, and here we go back to Kathy Busjancic.
The 10-year yield will reflect current economic activity, expectations for future economic activity, and also expectations for future interest rates set by the interest rate path for the Federal Reserve.
Expectations is the key word there, because once the government sells its bonds, investors, traders, really bond traders, take a look at the economy and ask not how are things going right now, but how do we think things are gonna be economically in the next couple of months and years? And that is why the bond market is really the one to watch. There is so much to explain in this economy. Let us know what you want to know. You can do that at marketplace.org, or you can tweet me. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. One of the cool things about history is that sometimes you can go back and pinpoint when things changed. Sometimes it's overnight. Sometimes it's over a couple of years. So we are going to go mid to late 1980s now, what was called the golden age of hip hop, when a bunch of hip hop artists, mostly from around New York and the East Coast, started to find mainstream appeal. Run DMC, Public Enemy, A Tribe Called Quest, also Eric B. and Rakim. Eric B. was the DJ, Rakim was the MC, eventually called one of the greatest hip-hop lyricists of all time. Rakim has written a book now about his start in music and his thoughts on creativity. It's called Sweat the Technique. Thanks for coming in.
Yes, sir. Thanks for the welcome, man.
We ought to begin by saying you didn't really originally plan this line of work for your life, did you?
Nah. On the whole spectrum, you know, coming up as a young kid, I thought I was going to be a football player. I thought I was going to be a quarterback. And I don't know if it was fate or I stopped growing, but I wound up being an MC. But I definitely don't regret it.
You've always been a writer, though, right? I mean, even from when you were like a teenager and a kid.
Yes, yes. I always loved writing art, love art, love drawing, and just had a great love for music.
So you make that first move into music and hip hop and doing this for a living, and I want to ask you to tell the story of those first couple of days when you went out with these guys that you hooked up with. And what they made of your style, because your style is actually kind of why and how you're known, right? And they tried to produce you a different way.
Yes, yes. They tried to change me up a little bit, but yes, man. I think I was about 17 when I met Eric B. and we started going to Marley Marl's house. And first day we got there, we started recording a song called My Melody. My style that I have is laid back. And at that time, 1986, you know, there wasn't too many, if any, rappers rhyming in that gesture. You know what I mean? So we get up in Marley Marl's house. He had a studio in his house. Marley Marl's a big-time producer from Queensbridge, huge at the time. We get up in his house, and we make the beat. And then it comes time for me to start recording my rhyme. So I'm sitting on his couch, and I start rhyming, and the song maybe gets halfway, a little more than halfway through the verse, and he stops the track, and he says, I like the rhyme, but could you put a little more energy in it? So, you know, not really thinking. I'm like, yeah, okay. So rhyming, maybe halfway through the song this time, and then he was like, why don't you try to stand up, maybe, you know. And by this time, you know, I kind of understand what he's trying to do and getting a little frustrated. And I, you know, I just tell him, look, man, if I sit down or if I stand up, it's going to sound the same way, man. This is how I rap, bro. You know what I mean? So we finally got through the session, man. And, you know, a couple weeks later, after the record came out, I seen Marley Marl and Shan, and, you know, they had a smile on their face and told me, like, they get it. And it was like, yeah, we get it now, man. We get it. So it was a crazy experience, but I'm glad that I held my guns, so to say.
Yeah. There's going to be a huge chunk of the audience listening to this interview that isn't going to understand what you mean when you're saying I was doing my rhymes and laying down my rap. So when you sit and do what you do or did when you were a younger man, what was your process? How'd you get there?
It was a lot different. I used to love listening to the track and just kind of, you know, zoning out and trying to understand the track before I would start writing rhymes. Coming up in my household again, a lot of jazz played in my house. My mother loved jazz. My father loved jazz as well.
So, you know, that's so interesting. I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's really interesting because one of the things I did before I sat down with you for this interview is obviously I watched a bunch of your stuff on YouTube. And okay. I was watching you on the NPR Tiny Desk concert.
Wow.
And two things about it. One was it is exactly like jazz. It's really syncopated. What you do is really syncopated and flowing. But the other thing is, and this is, I don't know, you tell me if it means anything, you did it with your eyes closed the whole time.
Yes, yes. We did that track a little faster than we usually do, than I usually do. And a lot of them rhythms and syncopations that I use in my rhymes, it seems like I can kind of hit it better with my eyes closed for some reason. It just helps me focus in. But I've been doing that song for maybe, I don't know, 20 years now. Yeah. But it's still, you know, certain songs that I do, certain parts that I get to, I just find myself being comfortable closing my eyes and being able to, I guess, see the music and see myself putting my words where they're supposed to be.
Do you ever listen back to your old stuff, or you just kind of keep on moving forward? Do you?
Yes. I, not as much as I should, but every chance I get, sometimes I have to remind myself exactly what it is that I do.
You've worked, obviously, with some of the greats, and now, arguably, you're one of the greats, right?
Yes.
When younger wannabe hip hoppers and rappers and MCs and DJs come to you and say, how do I get to where you are? What do you tell them?
Well, I think like some of the main things that I tell them is try to stay true to theyself. Number one, try to speak from the heart. And the most important thing is try not to let people outside dictate your career or tell you what you should or shouldn't be doing. A true artist already has a sense of what he or she should be doing. There's always room for creative criticism from those that know what they're speaking on, but it's very important that they have a sense of self and understand what they want to do so they don't get deterred when people come at them.
It's a book called Sweat the Technique, Revelations on Creativity from the Lyrical Genius, Rakim.
Yes, sir.
Thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it big time.
So, a couple of things about that interview. First of all, the book he wrote, Sweat the Technique, we've got an excerpt at our website, marketplace.org. Also, the music you're hearing on the show today, Rakim picked it out for us. The full playlist online for us as well. This final note on the way out today, in which I am going to say I told you so, even though I never technically told you so, but come on, this was always the way it was going to work out. Those stories a month or so ago that Marvel Studios and Sony had parted ways over Spider-Man, and so Spidey wasn't going to be part of the Avengers Marvel Cinematic Universe anymore? Yeah, no, a deal, surprise, surprise, was announced today. You want to know why? Because Spider-Man Far From Home, the latest in the franchise, it grossed $1.1 billion. That's why. Okay, we're going. Dow Industrial's down 70 points today, 0.2%. The NASDAQ lost 91 points, 1.1%. S&P 500 returned 15 points, about 0.5%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you on Monday. Everybody, have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.